Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I have Pete, Mr. Money Mustache. How's it going?
Surprise, surprise. Yeah, it's great to be back.
Yeah, and you are, you're a fixture on the show now. I would say you're in, I don't know, like a third of the episode. So it's good having you around, and I feel like we're becoming better friends just by recording together.
That's how it works. People just work together, and I feel like that's the best way for me to be.
Yeah.
To get to know everybody, get to know friends.
So last week, we talked about some other people that have, I guess, negative opinions about the FIRE movement, although some of them have positive opinions, but then they put a cloak of a clickbait title, and it maybe sounded like they didn't agree with the FIRE movement, but there's a wide spectrum. So that was pretty enlightening, kind of fun to do the research. But we don't think the FIRE movement's perfect either, and there are observations that we have, and that's what this whole episode is about. So I think we can just jump into some of the details, but I'll check with you, Pete, first. Any other opening thoughts?
Yeah. Well, that last episode was fun because it was trying to look at ourselves and see what the world is saying about us if we think of ourselves as the FIRE movement, and see what are their problems with these ideas. Are there genuine problems, or are we just portraying it wrong and things like that? And then this one is supposed to be more like a confessional, like we're looking at ourselves and saying like, okay, what are we doing really wrong? How has this worked out for so many of us who have been on FIRE, living a like early retired lifestyle for a long time, or like saving for it for a long time? And are we going off the rails, or is it still a good idea? Mm-hmm.
And great point. This is us being self-aware. And I thought it was important for us to also do this episode essentially saying, hey, we're not perfect and we're reflecting, we're kind of detaching, and we're evaluating it, hopefully from another perspective than our own for a second, at least as we're evaluating it. As we go through our day-to-day life, I think we're pretty locked in, but this is a good exercise.
Yeah. And the whole thing about like originally when I was calling my side of it mustachianism, it's not a religion, it's a fake religion, which means it has, you know, exuberant statements and ideas and beliefs, but you don't have to literally follow it like it's a gospel situation. It's mainly like, here's some ideas, try them and see what works for you. And then if we share ideas and figure out better things, then it gets modified real time.
That said, it could be interesting for people to know how you think about your writing persona versus your own personality. When I record on the podcast, I have to pump it up a little bit. I need to be a little bit more interesting. Not boring, but I'm a relatively quiet person. I think a lot of podcasters probably are. And you just have to like turn it up 10% or drink a bunch of caffeine or whatever, float your boat. But yeah, talk about how you write and if there is a huge difference between your personality versus like if someone reads your blog, are they going to find like a slightly different person?
Well, sometimes I'm embarrassed to admit this, but Mr. Money Mustache is pretty much me. When people read, they're like, oh yeah, he's obviously just being like way over the top and talking about this shit. He'd be an asshole if he was like that in real life. I'm like, oh, okay. But really it's almost like that. I mean, those genuinely are my beliefs. And I really do think, for example, that it's an absolute clown-like behavior to circle around a parking lot to try to get the closest spot and all these other things that humans do. So often I feel like I'm not a human because I'm like, why am I so different from these other behaviors? They all seem ridiculous to me. So in that way, I am like MM. But in real life, I also, you know, because I'm an adult and I've been around normal adults for a long time, I know how to be polite and I'm not going to say this stuff in people's face because I know they don't want to hear it. I'm not going to go up to the drive-through lineup in Starbucks and be like, you idiot, you could get that coffee faster if you just got out of the day. And why are you driving this fucking truck to work anyway? Like, there's nothing in the back. So yeah, I understand that that doesn't actually help in real life and it just gets you into fights.
Right. And to be fair, you never said anything to me about my V8 truck, in which I never fucking hauled hardly anything. Some yard debris, okay. I would use it occasionally, but you never said anything to me. But we didn't become good friends until I got rid of it.
Maybe there's a correlation. No, it really didn't. Yeah, it doesn't bother me too much. Now, if we were like doing stuff together, you know, working in a construction company together. And then we were always, you know, our tools were always flying out of the back of the truck. I'm like, Doug, we got to get a van for this thing. What's with this stupid open back? That's no good for contractors. You know, like, or if I was in the dating world, I probably wouldn't be attracted to a woman who drives like a Cadillac Escalade just because it's like kind of a value system difference.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Okay. And you started blogging, and I see your intro. I'm going to let you take this because I like the way you said it.
Oh, yeah. So the introduction is basically I started trying to share fire ideas way back in 2011. I think it was April of 2011. Mm-hmm. And I thought they would be perfect for everyone because I was a young man at the time, and I thought these ideas are great. And then as I started sharing them on the internet, I found more and more pushback and criticism from all different directions and lots of things that I didn't expect. I'm like, huh, I never thought that would be a problem, or I never thought anybody would think that way about it. So a lot of the subsequent many years of writing have been me like trying to refine it so it's more applicable to everybody. And what I've learned is that you're never going to get there. There's always going to be critics either who deliberately misread what you're doing as a way of just staking out their territory, or people who are new, who aren't getting the points. And that's just the internet. It's a big, messy, messy world. And the best you can do is be happy that anybody is reading your stuff and getting some benefit out of it.
And the quote from you is, I thought the fire ideas would be perfect for everyone. Then I met the internet.
Oh, yeah.
That's good. Yeah. So we'll enumerate these. Actually, we're not going to number them, but we'll go through these kind of topic areas, ideas like ultra frugality, over saving, over optimizing, having an identity crisis, which actually comes up in many different areas. One of the most common conversations I have when I'm talking to someone who has retired early, and often they had like a strong professional identity. Lawyers, doctors, those are the ones that come up often. So we'll go through some of these. And number one, these kind of early ideas from the FIRE movement predating me, a lot of these are around ultra frugality. And I think you even mentioned, I forget the guy's name, but
Jacob, early retirement?
Yes, yeah. That's right. So I famous, I believe, for $7,000 a year. I've heard people say it. I've never actually, you know, read it anywhere else. And living on rice and beans. And that was just like how he was living. And apparently it was fine. But like those stories stick really well.
Yeah. They scare people.
Yeah.
And even that wasn't accurate. Like Jake, I read all of the early retirement extreme blog before I started writing my blog. Like basically I did write my blog. Then I went on the internet to see if anyone else had written this. And then I was like, oh shit, this guy's already covered it. I can't start a blog. And then I went back and read all his back catalog, which is like hundreds of articles even back then.
Yeah.
And he also was not a rice and beans only guy. Not that there's anything wrong with those food sources, but he ate a super wide variety of super healthy foods.
Okay.
He was just a natural optimizer, and they grew food. They lived in San Francisco Bay Area, so they had year-round gardening. And they were super, he and his wife were both super healthy. Jacob, I mean, I'm sure he's still around, but super athletic, does all kinds of stuff. So there was really no compromise. He just happened to be like a hardcore Danish physicist, who likes to figure stuff out. But a lot of people aren't hardcore Danish physicists. So to them, his lifestyle was just sort of unfamiliar.
Yeah. So these are all the issues that we individually have with the FIRE movement. And we're going to disagree, I think, on some of these. So
no, we're not.
The ultra frugality is something that if it works for you, that's cool. But from an overall perspective, like now there's many different flavors of FIRE, and to the extreme of like fat FIRE, where people are spending, you know, a lot more money. I won't even put like a label on it because it's all relative to what you think is extravagant or not. But overall, the ultra frugality can be an issue. Number one, with like getting people interested in the movement, right? So if you talk to a young person and they're like, well, I don't want to skimp. I've worked so hard. I'm earning a lot of money. I want to spend that money. The ultra frugality can be a little abrasive. And then the more important secondary issue is once you do retire, let's say you're successful, you work, you do retire, you have a great plan to spend however much works for your portfolio, but you are resistant to actually like spend the money on things that you do find valuable and that you want to do, but you're like, I don't know if I could pay that much for a flight. Your mind is anchored to whatever flights in 2005 or something like that. So what's your take on this ultra frugality issue?
Yeah. Well, if you're a early retirement podcaster or writer, you really have to watch out for it. If you're trying to make these ideas sound good to people, you have to make sure it sounds applicable to your target audience. And after reading Jacob's stuff, I was eager to differentiate my writing. I'm like, oh, we're the normies here. This is a middle-class lifestyle. I remember one of my early sentences was like, I'm not trying to tell you how to live life on the cheap. I'm telling you how to live the good life on the cheap. So I focus on the fact that I did have, you know, like a 4-bedroom, 4-bathroom house throughout the MMM early years. And I had a car and I had a construction vehicle that was separate and had lots of bikes and all the other stuff that I wanted. We did lots of travel as a family. And despite all of that, it still added up to only a certain amount, which at the time was like $24,000 a year. Nowadays, it'd probably be like 35 if you think about the inflation changes. And you can still do that, right? Like today, 35 or whatever it is roughly the new 24. A family of four, if they have a paid off mortgage and live in a place without crazy high property taxes, you can live on 35K, 40,000, whatever. And just knowing that that's possible is important for people, because a lot of people who are spending 100 to 200,000 a year for what looks like almost the same lifestyle, that's like a huge margin that can get those people ahead. So anyway, to go back to your point is, I think advertising extreme frugality is not all that valuable if you're trying to create a big social change, because only a tiny percentage of people will be interested in it then.
One thing I want to go back on, slightly on a tangent. So you mentioned how much annual expenses might be for a family. Great, 35K. But you mentioned having a house that's paid for. I don't think that's realistic.
I mean, I think it is. It just...
Well, go on.
It totally depends on your prioritization of where you want to put your money. So The price of your house should never be more than the amount you need to retire. So it's just going to be a portion of your cost of living. So let's say you need to buy like groceries and pay for schools for your kids and whatever else you're buying, is going to take like a large number. It's going to be like somewhere in the $1 million plus range to fund your lifestyle, even before you account for housing. So then you have to add in the price of your housing, whether you're renting something or whether you own a house. Let's say like the average house price in the US is somewhere around $450 now. And that's like the average that's pulled up by a lot of the big expensive cities. Mm-hmm. So really there's a lot of places where houses are like $300,000 and less.
Yeah.
And whether you choose to borrow at a low interest rate, or a lot of people have low interest rates already from the 2021 era.
Right.
Or buy it in cash and not have any mortgage at all. That's just, you got to add that to your number. So your FI number, if you're homeless, might be $700,000. If you have a $300,000 house, then it's $1 million. Mm-hmm. That's your FI number, or like bigger, you know, it could be bigger numbers. So sure. It is realistic. Houses are not that expensive compared to the big money that we FIRE people can deal with, because we deal with hundreds of thousands like that. We save $100,000 a year quite often in the FIRE movement, sometimes $200,000 a year. And at that level of financial power, the price of a house is no longer a big 30-year, like, oh my God, you can never pay that off.
And it depends on, to your point before, like it depends on the audience that you're talking to, because I could imagine a wide, obviously, huge spectrum, although our audience is kind of like more advanced FI folks, but it's like someone in the first 10 years of their career versus like if they're whatever, 35 to 50, like maybe they have a great interest rate, maybe they've been in their house for 10 or 15 years. So like that's totally different. But anyway, just thinking of like the broad spectrum, and it's like, a lot of cities, it's like super expensive to buy a house. But to your point, you can move to a cheaper city, but then you got the job thing, whole other topic. I don't know.
And in a lot of cities are, if you're in a dense enough place, then renting just becomes what you do. Like, it's very rare that anybody's going to say, I live in Manhattan and I just like a single family house, right? There's like hardly any of them there. And they're going to be many millions of dollars in some kind of special protected area that hasn't been converted into skyscrapers that are for rent. So, you know, it's very niche depending on your, like housing is very specialized depending on how you choose to live, but.
Yeah. And your geography, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else in the ultra frugality topic area?
Well, I just think that if people do what works for them and what works for their family and spouse, if applicable, that's really the sustainable path to fire, because you can't be pinching somebody else's lifestyle, and you can't really even be pinching your own lifestyle. Like, if you don't enjoy it, then that's not really going to make your life better. You know, you don't want to say, well, I like living on $60,000 a year, for example. And this, let's assume they figure all the stuff out, because you cut out all the waste, because a lot of times you can cut your spending in half and still have just as good a life. But once you've done that, so you've cut out the waste, you're keeping everything you enjoy, don't go below that, because then it's going to be a fight against yourself and you're not enjoying stuff. And you're like, I wish I could spend 60, but Mr. Money Mustache says I have to spend 40, so I'm going to do it. And I cut out the stuff I do like. And then you get to your FIRE number and then you retire, and then you're still stuck at the 40 forever, which for some people might not work. I still think there's so much in between that's really that's where the discussion kind of doesn't get covered. And this is why I like to try to cover the details, because there's no such thing as a cost of living. There's a level of spending. And some people think like, well, it just costs this much. But if you look at their details, you're like, well, why are you spending so much on this or that? And they're like, I never thought about it. And there's just so often, there's the optimizations in American life are just wild how much you can do.
Very good. Yeah. Little overlap on some future topics, but I'll mention that to your point, if you are going below that sort of like minimum level of what your enjoyment is and your family, then it'll feel like deprivation. And again, on the ultra frugality front, we spend a lot on food. Like I started buying like better food because it fits in our budget. And then hobbies, like I have some hobbies, Elizabeth has some hobbies, and some of them are more expensive, where in the past, maybe we'd think, I don't know if I'm going to spend that much, but it turns out it's a hobby and it's a pastime, and you need to fill your time with something. Like one issue is like people could be bored if they retire and they don't have work anymore. But if you have hobbies and things to do, then you tend not to be bored. So if you can't spend the money, then you may run into an issue. Because it turns out many hobbies are free, hiking, like certain exercise and stuff like that. But then you could also maybe join a gym that is more expensive, but that's a great pastime, a good healthy thing to do. It could be social as well. So sometimes it's okay to spend what seems to be what your past self would have assumed is a absurd amount of money.
Yeah. Yeah. Stuff really loosens up as you get older is what almost everybody who follows this path has. You start out with lower income, your income goes up, your savings go up, your budget could expand. So you have to kind of consciously remember that you can expand it if you want.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. All right. Next one is oversaving. So this is around basically like one more year syndrome. And I think we may do a shorter episode coming up. So we're not going to hit that too hard. But basically, when people are looking at their numbers, their portfolio, and they're thinking, a little bit would be a little bit, a little bit better, right?
Yeah. You know what I would love to do is have a guest on, like a third guest, or you could have somebody instead of me or whatever, but where are they, someone who has a really bad case of one more year syndrome and go through the details, but you do it kindly. You wouldn't be all Dave Ramsey who's like, why are you doing that? You could have quit 5 years ago.
That was a good impression. You should do like a whole show as him.
Maybe I'll get my Dave Ramsey costume ready.
Oh man. Yeah. And you've done some coaching. Like what have you seen without, you know, revealing anything specific?
Yeah, one more year syndrome happens at all levels of wealth, which is fascinating to me. Like I would have thought it would be a debate between like, in today's dollars, like, do I need $1.5 million or do I need $2 million or like 2.5, depending on how many people are in your family. But no, it just keeps going. Like I would have thought nobody would say I need more than $5 million to retire, for example, because that's like a $200,000 annual income using the 4% rule. And I'm like, who could possibly need more than 200,000? That's like a top 1% level of spending. But no, I've met people who have substantially more than that, multiples of that, and still think, I know I'm very well off. I'm very grateful for what I've been blessed with, but just one more year because of the huge bonus coming down the pike or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. And then, and they think that when they retire, they have to cut down their lifestyle. But even if their lifestyle is only, you know, like if you have a lifestyle that's very high, $400,000 a year, but you have $20 million invested, you're still, you're living at like a 2% withdrawal rate, which is, you could double your spending and still never run out. So that kind of, you just have to always remind yourself, like when the numbers get bigger, you have to constantly reevaluate. Otherwise, you're going to make some irrational decisions.
A lot of times, and you've probably seen this more, but anecdotally with some of my conversations, people, maybe they don't take Social Security into account or some other aspect, like naturally spending a little bit less, maybe when their kids move out or something like that. There's like some, there's some hard facts in there that they should be able to make a strong assumption about a reduction in spending or something different without making a huge leap. And I think people just, they chronically underestimate like how good things could be, and they overestimate like the expenses and downsides, and it compounds dramatically, especially with long-term projections, 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And people have this, this default assumption where they're like, well, yeah, that good thing could happen, but I don't want to count that just in case. Like someone who comes from a family where the parents are relatively well off, parents are 85 years old. They're like, yeah, but I love my mom and dad. So I'm not going to assume that their $10 million fortune is going to pass to like me and my one sibling. I'm just not going to, I'm like, okay, you don't have, it's not going to make your parents live any longer or have, you know, your relationship's not going to be better by mentally writing off that inheritance. So why not just like use it to at least reduce your worry? And then likewise with Social Security, I'm actually writing my next blog post about Social Security because I realized that I've kind of ignored it for so long because I thought I was too young to think about it. And then suddenly I woke up and I'm 51 now. I'm like, wow, it's only 8 years until, 8.5 years or something till eligibility for Social Security. And the numbers are significant for if you're in the lower cost of living type of life, you know, like I'll get $2,000 a month added to my budget in the, and it's going to keep going up with inflation. So whatever the, whatever feels like $2,000 a month, 9 years from now is when I'm going to add it. And I've never budgeted for that. So it's going to be just that much more cozy for me, means in theory, I can spend more of my money now and I could like run out and that would take over and replace some of it.
Yep.
And that applies to a lot of people.
And I think those kind of projections, we're smart people. Right. I mean, we could put together a good spreadsheet, but some of those factors and their things come and go. Like, let's say you buy a new car every 10 years and it's going to cost $40,000 or $50,000, whatever you want to put in your budget. But these kind of like little projections or infrequent expenses that'll come up, it can be really helpful to go to an advisor everyone has a different comfort level, but like to see those projections and if it gives you like freedom of spending a little more now, because you can run one of your buckets down to zero. Like you're supposed to spend the money, right? Like we've saved it, we will spend it. Some buckets are going to hit zero and then we'll switch over to a different bucket and consult your own professionals. But it can be very useful to have a third person or a third party look at it. Again, we're smart. You can have a friend who's actually a CFP look at it, but it's probably better to pay someone that you have a professional relationship. We may debate on that, but I don't know.
I would say, if you think you have some problems, either like emotionally, you're not feeling great about your retirement finances or you're uncertain about things, then hiring or working with somebody is a great idea. Mm-hmm. And for me, the reason I wouldn't do that, at least in my current setup, is I'm just very comfortable with everything. Like everything's great. I love making spreadsheets. I love just feeling the abundance of, you know, like every time I look at stuff, I'm like, oh, cool, I'll be fine, even if I spend more. And that's cool. So if I need adjustment, I'll do it. But so far,
so good.
Yeah.
All right. Next one is over-optimizing. And engineers are the worst. I'm sorry to call you out. I'm technically an engineer. Pete, you are?
Yeah, that was what my degree and my career was in.
So we know all too well, engineers do not like waste. You want to be efficient. And there's so many engineers in the FIRE community. You bump into them all over the place. And it's really hard to stop over-optimizing, but sometimes it's not worth it. Can you think of examples where you've let go on some over-optimization?
Well, I certainly, when it comes to housing, because I really enjoy having a house, I like the idea of, I always tend to have like a nicer house than I would strictly need. Mm-hmm. And I'll buy nice things for the house. You know, like I replaced my appliances with even nicer appliances a few years ago, just because I was like, yeah, why struggle with this ice maker that's annoying or whatever. So I feel I'm okay with that. And same with the car, you know, like I got a nice car, more than I needed, because I my life changed in such a way that I was driving more and doing all these great vacations. And I'm really glad I did that. Mm-hmm. So it's not optimized because it's just sitting there a lot of the time, because I'm not a commuter or anything. So I have this $50,000, originally it was that much, car just sitting there, sometimes not getting used for 5 or 6 days until the next time I have an adventure. But I don't try to optimize it or put it on Turo or anything like that, because I don't need the money and I like to just relax. On the other hand, here's a confession. So I'm a little bit of an optimizer, too much on like energy efficiency, just because that's like such an interesting field to me. You know, I love energy and electricity and power and batteries and solar stuff. So I have a hot tub in my house, outside my house, and I have a hard time letting myself use it if there's no guests, right? Especially in the winter, because like you have to heat this huge 300 gallons of water up, and I know exactly how many kilowatt hours that is using. And I'm like, it's just going into the sky, man. Like, I don't really need a hot tub tonight. You know, let's just wait until there's someone coming over, and then we'll heat it up and we'll all have fun.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. Whereas normal people, they just leave their hot tub hot all the time and they get in and out. And like, I wish I could relax in that way. And it's a small amount of money. It's like, I think you'd waste like $50 of electricity per month to keep a hot tub hot all the time. So like, that's my worst case, $50. And I waste that much on all kinds of other things without thinking about it, like a dinner out or whatever.
Yeah.
But for some reason, $50 of electricity floating up into the sky in the form of steam, I haven't quite got over that. So I'm working on that.
And you know,
it's confession.
I want to thank you for revealing that. And I want to make fun of you on it. But the thing is, even if you're in the hot tub for like a full session that evening, like how long are you in there?
Yeah, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 minutes until you start getting like
a little
tired
pruny. So like, I'm like, you know, you're only in there for a little bit and you're like, it's wasting energy. And I understand.
And a lot of times I'm away from my house for several days at a time.
Right.
Like at least a few days a week, I'm not at my house. So then I come back and it's cooled back down unless I leave it hot the whole time. So either one of those feels wrong to me until I can train myself to relax.
Right. Yeah. That's a tough one. Mm-hmm. I guess, the big thing is you'd have to, like, if you used it every single day, then you're like, okay, a couple bucks a day, not bad. All right. Yeah, that's good. Good confession. If people have suggestions, you can leave a comment over on the YouTube side. And I think I have an example from Brandon, Mad Scientist. I think I listened to him on a podcast, and maybe it was on his own feed. I can't remember, but he mentioned that he used to manage his expenses very closely. He would have spreadsheets and go through each month and look at every expense. And in the last few years, he's kind of let go, and he kind of looks at it, if I heard it right, on an annual basis. And he's like, are we within like the budget that we could afford? And I'm pretty sure he's like far under, under that. Mm-hmm. And it's good for him to let go and like just be able to spend a little more freely and not thinking, because what happens is you're making like small decisions all the time. Like when I go to the grocery store, I'm like, oh, is it a little cheaper to get this product or that product? Is it like 4 cents cheaper? And it's like, that's a dumb optimization, like saving 4 cents at a time. It's like, it'll be big stuff. Like, don't have my truck, right? Like that's a huge like shift in expenses and other decisions, but making those small evaluations like all the time, not super helpful. And again, Brandon's probably still pretty conscientious about like what he's spending, even though he's let go.
Yeah, that's true. A five person letting loose is still way more efficient than your average middle class person of that sort of wealth bracket thinking they're cutting back. So it's like, there's a big difference of skill, kind of just like a spending skill. Yeah. I think, I don't know if this is an appropriate time in our flow to mention it, but
sure.
There was a recent thing in the New York Times, this really long, like chatty article about a family who spends $700 per week on DoorDash delivery. Holy shit. And it's just like a family of four, two little kids, two parents, and lots of quotes from them and all these beautiful photographs of like, yeah, we're just so busy and it's so yummy to get this stuff delivered, but man, sure is expensive. And it's like hilarious. And people have, it's been circulating in the FIRE community and people are like, oh, this must be rage bait for Mr. Money Mustache. Like, that's how I heard about it. Someone on Twitter forwarded it to me. It is quite silly. And that's quite common. I would say like this family is maybe an extreme example, but a lot of people in the middle class, upper middle class income band are on that spectrum of the DoorDash spectrum. Maybe this should even be a new thing.
Interesting.
Because I think about this of like, they were just saying like, they don't have time to cook or they don't know how to cook. But even if you don't want to cook at all, like you can just go to Costco and buy all these pre-made, like really, really nice dishes.
Yeah.
And even if it's 100% pre-made and you're doing nothing beyond like putting it in the microwave, it's still going to be $150 a week versus the $700 for the same number of meals that you're replacing,
right?
Seven dinners or whatever. So it's like quite insane how much of a difference that is. And like tips for the driver every day too. Like just the tips you're going to spend is going to be more than the food at a proper grocery establishment.
And I'm an oddball in this way. And maybe this is me being a little frugal, but I've never used DoorDash, right? So even if we're ordering out, like typically I'll go pick it up just because I would have to download the app and whatever other bullshit, like there's enough barrier. So I've never used it, number one. But then I like to cook and I enjoy going to the store and just, I'm not snobby about it, by the way. Like I will eat garbage food from fast food, especially on a road trip or if I'm traveling or whatever, give me a food truck. I'll eat like fish and chips or whatever. Like I'll eat a lot of unhealthy food. But that also means like at home, I'm eating mostly healthy most of the time. Not always, but most of the time.
Yeah.
And that just works for me. But yeah, when I hear of people, I mean, that I could probably afford to use DoorDash, but I would be like, holy shit. Like this is way too expensive for whatever bullshit food this is.
Yeah. Now, if you think of it as a treat, I mean, I've used DoorDash and the other types of deliveries, and it's super fun in some cases. Like you get home from a trip with your friends, your girlfriend or whatever, and then you're like, let's get some Indian food tonight. And then it feels really decadent. And like, yes, you spend $50 for two people to eat, but it's such a treat and you're celebrating it. And then you have leftovers the next day as well. So really it's two meals.
Fair.
And it never really adds up to much if you think of it that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think of delivered food as your actual source of calories, then that's when you end up with this like $28,000 a year takeout bill that this family has. It's $700 a week. So more like $35,000, $38,000, you know, depending on how it rounds up, which is more than I spend entirely like for my whole life, including, you know,
trips,
my son being with me a lot of the time. And trips, and all my business expenses are included in that too, like stuff that really my business paid for, but I included it on my personal budget just to be extra transparent.
Sure.
The last time I wrote an article about this, it was still only in the 30s.
Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy that you could spend more than that just on the DoorDash portion of your budget.
Man. So over-optimizing, that could be an issue, but people can let go. And I was going to say, for me, I've escaped some of the maximizing and optimizing ideas from engineering. And I've let go. There's waste in a system and that's okay with me. And I don't find it particularly fun to optimize a lot of things. There's a handful of things that I'm probably interested in, but most things I don't give a shit.
Do what you enjoy.
Yeah.
And it will benefit you because you're having fun doing it. And presumably it saves you some money. So that's a cool thing. I love biking. For my transportation, saves me money, but that's not the reason I do it. I do it because it's healthy and makes me feel good. It's like, it's a win-win.
Yeah. Next one is an identity crisis. So there's a few of these. The first one, a lot of these are related to spending. So this one is like being too frugal, where someone says, hey, I'm too frugal. And our friend Mindy, so you guys were doing one of the first virtual events at the Phi Collective, and you and Mindy and Carl answered some questions, and Mindy commented like, hey, I'm like a frugal person by nature. And I was like, is that true? And I don't know if it's true. Maybe there is a frugal gene. I'm not sure. But I was like, mm-hmm. things are a skill and people make a decision on like how they want to be. And again, it ties back to the ultra frugality. But I want to call out a specific idea, and that's paying for convenience. And quick example, I've heard of people, again, driving around to find the cheapest parking. Like maybe you're going to an event downtown. So they drive around to find the cheapest parking and they save like $5 or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, is that a good use of time? Or maybe they're thinking, hey, we'll walk 2 miles. It could be healthy to walk, but instead of like getting an Uber for whatever, however much it costs, even if it's like $25 to mm-hmm. go the couple miles, if the weather's not good, but people are just sometimes unwilling to spend for convenience. And I'm like, you could save yourself a lot of time and headache yeah. and just be a little bit more pleasant to be around.
Yeah, right. Especially if you're imposing that on your friends. Like your friends are all like, let's go to the Taylor Swift concert. Oh, of course, that's a silly example because the tickets alone were $700 or something.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, let's go to the concert. And then you're saying, no, I don't want to park at this expensive lot. Let's park at the far one. And you're trying to push it on other people. That's extra bad. Stuff for yourself, you should still question yourself. But
sure.
sometimes it can still be fine. You're like, if you enjoy it or you enjoy trying it once.
Totally. Yep. I think your caveat is important. If it's you by yourself, then you learn a lesson, you like it or you don't like it, you enjoy the extra walk or whatever. There's reasons to do that stuff. But yeah, when you're like shifting a group to like chase your tail to save like $5, it's like, oh man,
yeah.
like what?
And I really like, there's a really good example in our area because the Denver airport has two parking lots. It has one where you can, it's close enough, you can walk into the terminal.
Yeah.
And it makes your trip joyful if you happen to be driving to the airport, which a lot of us way out in Longmont, out in the sticks, have to do.
Yep.
Because there's no public transit to the airport. So that one's $20 a day. Or for $8 a day, you can park a few miles down the road and there's a free shuttle bus that takes you there. And so it works out to being like a difference of $50 to $100 per trip. And the younger me would be like, oh yeah, I'm definitely taking the shuttle bus. That's like $50, no way. And now I always park in the expensive lot because I just savor that walk. I'm like, look at me.
Glorious,
I'm
right?
Not on the shuttle bus. I would be jammed in with this shitty diesel thing, standing up with everyone's suitcases rattling against me. And it's not even there when you need it. Like you get out of your car at the distant parking lot and you're even just waiting for the bus. I'm like, oh, when's it going to come?
Right.
That at both ends of the trip, it just ruins the whole trip. So the new spendy version of me is like, I'm just going to spend the extra $100, even though my whole plane ticket might have only been like $100 to $200, just because it makes that part of my trip better. So it's a way of trading money for pleasure that I'm yeah. totally not against.
Great example. And we could dig into the flight stuff more too, because there's a lot of ways to spend money at the airport. Mm. So one is the timing of your flight or connections, right?
Yeah,
so like there's some very cheap flights on Frontier around here. Mm-hmm. And often the cheapest flights are like, they're leaving at 6 a.m. or something like that.
Yeah.
Which see above, it takes us an hour to get to the airport and do, you know, park and get in there or whatever. So you got to get up kind of early, or you can get the whatever 10 a.m. flight or noon or whatever.
Yeah, it's like $100 more.
Yeah.
But
so worth
better day.
Yeah.
And for me, if I have a 6 a.m. flight, I'm not going to sleep the whole night before because I'm going to be worried about getting up
yeah.
early. So it's like a ridiculous paradox where like I can't sleep, even yeah. though I could easily just get 6 hours of sleep instead of 8 and it would be fine.
Yeah.
But no, it's my body's like, nope, you get 0 hours. So that rules out the 6 a.m. flight for me, like regardless of the cost difference.
Yeah. And then the other, which I'm curious if you've shifted, I've been testing this out. It's good so far, but just getting the economy plus seats or whatever with a little bit more space. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they've gotten more expensive. I remember back in the day, it was only like $20 to upgrade or whatever.
Yeah.
Now to get the 2 inches more in your seat, it's like almost $100 each way, right?
Right.
It's like $90 or so. Mm-hmm. So have you explored this bigger seat thing?
I don't have a problem. I mean, yes, I have definitely bought that in the past. Mm. Usually I pay more to be closer to the front of the plane.
Okay.
I don't care as much about the size because I can fit easily. To me, there's great pleasure in just getting off the airplane instead of having to watch for everybody fucking with their luggage, like so slow. I'm like, come on, you could have taken that down 10 minutes ago. And like, I watch as they're like, the aisle just, it's empty most of the time because like this person's, okay, I'll stand up and get my luggage. Anyway, it's just like, it's infuriating to me. And this is probably my engineering side. And I've trained myself to like not look when people are getting out. I just like read a book and don't even let myself look up because it's going to make me furious. And then I wait till it's time for me to go. And then I do my job to get out fast and not hold anybody else up. But still, the closer you are to the front of the plane, the less that happens. So I'm willing to pay a lot for that.
And then, the funny thing, I'm with you, but I guess years ago, I've like just resigned and I'm like, all right, this is just going to be a total mess for the next 20 minutes and it's going to be a while before I get off the plane
here. Yeah. And it's not that bad as long as you're not watching, at least for me. And if you close your eyes or read a book or whatever, do some stuff.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
And patience. Yeah. Patience is a challenge for me. It's been something I work on over the decades because I like efficiency, man.
So one thing I did for convenience that reveals my incongruent mindset is I paid to have my sprinklers winterized and blown out for $75, and it saved me a couple hours of time. We mentioned it before. I usually borrow your compressor, and I learned how to do it, and it was fun and enlightening. And then after a few years, I was like, I don't really care about this, and how much can it cost? But you mentioned something that I didn't even realize.
Well, I mean, I think it's good that you tried it. So I can't give you shit for that. For other people who are like, I just don't want to learn, so I'm going to pay what usually ends up being $100+ every year. Those people should learn about sprinkler maintenance because you own the sprinkler system. You should know how to take care of it. But then I thought that was funny, a contrast from your DoorDash thing, because you're like, I've never used DoorDash, which is typically less than $75, but yet you DoorDashed an air compressor, which is basically what it is to have a guy do that for you. So it's all right though. We don't have to be rational.
Yeah, but trade-offs.
Yeah, but I do think if you get the app, and they'll even give you your first delivery for free, which is fun. It's a fun thing to have if you and your wife would enjoy sometimes a little surprise
meal. Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. Okay, let's push on to the next one, which is another identity crisis where we're too focused on the future. And the thing is, if you're successful and you retire early, you have been focused on the future very effectively. It's had a huge impact on your life. You're able to stop working. But if you keep doing that, then you're always kind of living for the future. So it's a hard balance because we should always think about the future and a couple of steps ahead. But at the same time, if you're always saving money for some day in the future, then you never actually spend it. And then you're just waiting for tomorrow endlessly.
And you miss out on your youth. And I'm somewhat glad that I enjoyed all the things that I did in the first 20 years of retirement, like that I wasn't. When I look back, there are not too many things that I was stingy about that made life less fun. If I could relive it, I'm sure I'd be a bit more relaxed, but it was pretty good.
Yeah.
But now I've been getting even more conscious about making sure I'm not saving for the future because I'm at this age, 51 years old, like 9 years, I'm going to be 60. Like that's I'm going to be starting getting senior discounts within 15 years or less. And one example is that I decided to buy another house, which I just got under contract for, which is in this really, really nice neighborhood in Denver, but it's expensive. And I also wanted to make sure could have got a cheap house or like been on the edge of the neighborhood that's not as nice, or rent got like a condo or something and saved a lot of money. But then I thought, well, then you're just going to have bigger numbers in your account and you're not going to have the fun stuff that you've been realizing you really want. Like the main shortcomings of my current house is there's no place to put the music set up with drums. There's not enough space for the gym, the weight set up, and you know, little things like that. So instead, I just decided I'm going to spend more, buy the house. I have to like take money out of investments to pay for this house. It's raising my cost of living significantly, especially because I'm also going to keep my house in Longmont, at least for the first year, so that I don't have to rush to evacuate and sell this place. And I have so many connections in Longmont, like my Mile High Phi job, unpaid career with you, as well as the Phi Collective co-working space, social club. So basically I'm voluntarily raising my cost of living huge. It's going to like double or more for basically permanently because the new house is like a lot more. It's like a $700,000+ house. So, but I can afford it, and it's just, it means that I'm going to have a smaller amount of surplus. And I think I had to really talk myself into this, but I'm like, yeah, that's what you do when you're 50. You're going to enjoy the next 20 years of like middle age in this gorgeous neighborhood where everything's nearby and it's walkable and there's happy, healthy people all around and it's quiet and all the stuff that is getting improved compared to my already admittedly pretty good lifestyle here. Yeah, just do it. It's okay to be less rich on paper and have a more rich life in the overall package.
Mm. Yeah, congrats on the house. Super cool. Sad to see you go, but you'll be around for a little while.
Oh, yeah. You won't even notice the difference is what I tell people, my Longmont friends, because I'm still going to be here plenty. I still have the business here and the house here. So, and I've already been spending a lot of my past year in Denver. So, it's just like making it more formal.
Pretty cool. All right. And it sounds good. You're going to have a music room down there.
Yeah.
Facility.
There's a room very much like the one we're in.
Okay.
Same size. It's going to be a great.
Awesome.
Great jam room. Soundproof because it's underground.
Very good. All right. And have you observed, like with some of your coaching, people that are too focused on the future or maybe like people, this is one thing I see, like people that are already retired and they're still saving. Like they should be at a point where they're drawing down or spending a little bit more, but they're like, I'm actually still saving. And like, look how frugal I still am.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did you do all that work, all the extra hours and the other sacrifices to just like not take advantage of it at all?
Yeah. Well, if the people are really living their life without cost as a concern, according to the values, then it's okay to still be saving, right?
Like
I was doing that myself where with my life only being $30,000, it was almost impossible not to make more than that.
Right.
With like just owning the co-working space that has like a small, very small income and owning the blog, which used to have a large-ish income, which is now a small income as well. But that's still more than $30,000. And that's not even counting like the dividends and stuff that come in on the old investments.
Right.
So tried to increase my spending and I did, but I'm not just going to like start lighting money on fire. I do like give some of it away, but even so I was like saving more. And I think now with the new house, I might've cured my saving habits because the money that would have gone into my savings per month is now going to go to pay for this new cost of keeping up another place.
Fair. Yeah. And that totally makes sense. I mean, you'll need to furnish it. It's a bigger house, right?
Yeah.
So even if you move all your stuff over, you'll have to get a couple little things here and there.
Yeah. Anyway. And you're paying like 2 internet bills for a year and 2 gas bills and all that other stuff. So it'll be a good use of spending, a good way to spend some money. And I'm going to renovate the thing too. So lots of materials.
And good example of like letting optimization go, obviously paying for two redundant things. That's a big, big step. Do you have any identity crisis yourself with that? Or
It took me a while to talk myself into it because I was thinking like when you do the numbers, which I can't help doing, then it's like a lot of like if you think about the $700,000 and 4%, that's like $28,000 that it just costs, whether not even counting the property taxes on the house and all the other costs of keeping it, but just having that capital deployed into a chunk of real estate. Or if I borrow against it, you know, if I borrow to pay for it, it's the same thing. You know, if you can borrow your money at 4 or 5%, mortgage rates are higher than that. So for most people, it's even more than that.
Yep.
But it's like, you know, an extra $30,000 a year that's just getting vacuumed away just by the presence of this building in my life.
But tons of enjoyment. So good trade-off.
Right.
Good
trade-off. It's money that my investments are earning for me that would normally just reinvest and compound. And now it's just going to more slowly reinvest and compound. Like it's not even going to eat up all of my retirement passive income. So I just had to remind myself, like if you have enough, it's okay to be a bit wasteful as long as you're doing it on purpose.
Consciously deliberate. Okay. Yeah. And we kind of blended there. Here we have another one. I'm a saver. And this is another mindset kind of thing where people are just like, yeah, I need to keep saving. So it's the other side of this is they don't want to sell shares. They don't want to spend. They don't want to get to the point. Like you said, you struggled with it for a little while, but you came around. You're like, this is going to be okay.
Yeah.
Did you have to sell any shares or do anything like that? Or did you just borrow against your equities?
Yeah. Well, this is a good technical thing that I might put into a blog post because it's fun for people. So what happened in my situation is I knew I was going to be buying a house. So I stopped my habit of investing any spare money for the past year and just built it up in cash. So I had like a bit of a cash cushion, which is going to go towards the house. But then for the rest of it, I am going to use a margin loan against this big batch of money I have in a taxable brokerage account. So, and it's because the interest rate is low enough that it's worth it for me at this point. So I can borrow at today's, I can borrow it at 4.7%.
Okay.
So I'm taking the whole purchase price of the house out of this account, paying what feels like cash from the seller's perspective. And now I just have a negative 700K balance in my brokerage account, which is accruing interest at this rate. And then all the, I'm going to gradually pay that off, but it's just not a rush because in theory, those investments are making more than 4.5% over time, just on average. So I'll just like, as I earn money, I'll pay off the house balance. And also each year I'm going to sell some shares to pay off a chunk, like let's say $100,000 worth. And the reason I'm spreading it out is just for tax efficiency, right? Because that's going to put me into a higher tax bracket. So if I sold 700K in 1 year, then the IRS is like, oh, thanks, Mr. Richie Rich, for your $700,000 taxable income. You're in the top bracket and we'll just take like 39% off of that or whatever it is.
Right.
So I'd have to sell like $1 million of shares to pay off a 700K house. But if you do it over a series of multiple years, then you're squeaking through in the lower tax brackets and you're keeping more money invested. So it's growing. And like, of course, based on all this stuff we're talking about in this episode, you could say, well, why do you care about even optimizing that? And you're right. I could just sell the $1 million of shares and then just totally sit back. But I'm just doing it because I enjoy it. Like to me, it's fun to move money around in accounts and do it. And it's not like work in a negative way. Mm-hmm. It's not like I'm waiting in line to fill out forms in a government office or anything. I'm just like clicking some stuff on these fun financial websites.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to do to pay it off. I'll probably pay it off over like a 5 to 10 year period.
Okay. Next question was going to be like, oh, what time frame? But great point. I mean, this is an efficient use of like optimization where you could ignore so many things that are not optimized if you're saving like 250K on taxes on this one thing that is a fairly simple exercise where you're like, okay, here's the plan on the payoff. Here's how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And you understand what's going on. And then you could screw up in like 100 other places that are like $15 or whatever.
That's a good point. And it really helps to know about money and investing. I mean, just the fact that I knew to invest in index funds versus gambling on individual stocks like Enron and Bitcoin and whatever else, like it's why my wealth has grown very nice and stable and at a relatively fast clip over the last 30 years that I've been investing or whatever.
Yeah.
So that makes a difference of multiple millions of dollars by the time you get to my age versus someone who doesn't know how to invest and just like either spends it or puts it in a checking account. Mm-hmm. So millions goes a long way.
Yeah.
And I should mention also that I'm going to sell my Longmont house in a year into the future. So that will pay off a lot of the house, right? I feel like it might be worth about 500. Mm-hmm. So then I'd even theory, like if I don't pay any other chunks off, then I'd still only have a 200,000 balance on the house transfer in exchange for a house that's actually twice as big. It's got double the square footage.
Nice.
And it's in a nicer neighborhood and it's in the central of a big city. So
very cool.
Like a good move.
Yeah, yeah. Can't wait to check it out. All right. Coming up on the last one here. There's advice out there that people should retire to something. And I think this is generally bad advice, but highly debatable. I think it's very dependent on the individual. But here's the people that it's probably bad advice for. If you're like type A and you're thinking, I need something to retire to, and then you create some business that takes up all your time, then you're just shifting from like one work, one stress source to another that you've created yourself, which actually hurts even more because you're like, ah, fuck, I've created a job that I don't like. Mm-hmm. And it'll sneak up on you. Like I've seen people like create, you know, something small and they grew into something big because their background, their training was like, how do I grow this? Like, how do I maximize the scale of whatever it is that I'm working on? And I think it's really important to have open space to sit with your thoughts and essentially conquer your demons or whatever. You're not going to be able to conquer them all, but you're going to have to like figure some shit out and it's not going to be easy.
Yeah. And this is one place we might disagree, but it really depends if we had individual stories or people to interview that might help us understand this better. But
totally.
Because I did retire to something and it was, I just wanted to retire to my weekends because my weekends were very full of awesome activities, involved a lot of creating as well. Like I've always been into the construction, but still like the hikes and the vacations and camping and then child raising. So I had plenty to do when I retired to those things. And I wouldn't have had time to keep a career and have any semblance of this life I've enjoyed for the last 20 years. Like it just wouldn't work with two together. So I definitely retired to something. I also did what you said by accident is I started a business that was too much for a retired person, especially as a new dad at the time.
Yeah.
So that was a stupid idea. The house construction, like big house construction company, that was bad. So somewhere in between is good. Like just make sure you know what you will be doing with your free time, at least for the first few months, or make sure there's a lot of people involved, you know, socialization and stuff, creativity, exercising your creativity, I think is a real thing. Instead of retiring to consume, you should be retiring to produce in whatever that means to you.
Yeah.
Like you produce a lot of stuff.
I believe, yeah, you nailed it. I think the most popular story that I don't think works out well is someone retires and they play video games all day. It's like, that's not going to work. And same thing with like scrolling. Usually those folks hit some level of depression. And some of my friends have done this and they're like, oh yeah, I just played video games. I don't play video games. So I don't relate.
I think my policy is video games are not allowed for adult men. Like I understand that we grew up as gamers, especially people who are 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
But it's for your kids. You got to be done with video games by, let's say, 18 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have a hobby, that's great. You could explore that more. Fitness is great. I mean, that's a thing you're never going to be able to master and challenge. Mm-hmm. And it's a battle to like eat healthy and there's barriers in the way for that, but like it's something you could work on every day and it's a challenge. And music is fantastic. If that's not your thing, find some other creative outlet. But like, yeah, you should have something to occupy your time. But I think the big thing, you know, you mentioned you wanted your weekends to get bigger. Carl has mentioned this. The weekends, you know, you're doing the thing that you enjoy probably. And then it just kind of expands. Now you can gradually get into it. I think that's a great move to go from full-time to part-time. And then you can like let the transition happen a little slower, which is kind of what happened with me naturally through working from home, being self-employed and just like scaling everything down. So it happened over the course of years. So it was really easy for me to like just not do much in the productivity sense. But I think especially the type A people, they take it too far.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, for most people we know, the fire situation works out great.
Yeah. And
we have a slightly biased sample because we're meeting them through this Phi Collective social club. So they're pretty much social people by definition, but that's why they're a good role model. They're doing stuff together. They're doing a mixture of like working on stuff or volunteering or creating. And it's such a neat, fun, random combination and helping each other with their projects and everything. So just find that and you can do it in your own community. And man, like even when I move to this new neighborhood, my friends that I already have there, we've already resolved to start sort of a Phi Club of Central Park. And it'll be, you know, we're going to find new people both through our online platforms and through real life and just kind of get a big meetup thing going on there.
Nice.
And do things together because that's just what life is, makes life better.
Yeah. Yeah. The social aspect is huge. And not everybody has like the luxury that we have in this area, but there's like Choose Phi groups all over the country. Some are more active than others. And I mean, I think they're trying to really like get those groups rolling again. If they become inactive, some are hugely active all the time. But yeah, there's people around. And if you could find a hobby, and they don't have to be five people, by the way, it's great to have like diverse hobbies with other people outside our, you know, Phi area. Yeah, because there's a lot of different hobbies people are into, whatever it might be.
And that's why if you happen to be a video game heavy user right now, it might be papering over or masking the need of your life to have other things that are richer in experience. So like you take that away from yourself by choice and you're like, whoa, I feel this void of entertainment and stuff to do. And you're like, that's right. You need to fill that void, and then you need to fill it with something that's more genuine. Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably going to be a more sustainable long-term life.
We covered our main issues with the FIRE movement. Do you have any final thoughts, Pete, you want to share?
No, I never have final thoughts. My thoughts happen in the middle.
Right. Yeah, we don't need to tie it up in a bow, but we will be recording another episode, kind of a quick hitter, where we'll talk about one more year syndrome a little bit and a couple issues that people may have if they're thinking about retirement. I'm not 100% sure how it'll go, but it's going to be awesome whenever it comes out. So thanks, Pete. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Doug. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Fi podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. A few weeks ago, I went to a magical place called Casa Bonita. I'm drinking out of a coffee mug that I purchased from their gift shop there. Are you familiar with this wonderful Mexican restaurant?
I sure am. And of course, South Park made many more people familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. And for people that don't know, this is a restaurant in, I think it's technically in Denver, and it was started in the early 70s, I think 1973 per my coffee mug here. And it has had like ups and downs, but the guys that started South Park, I think they're from Littleton. So they went to Casa Bonita as kids. And in 2000, I think whatever, five or so, they had an episode where Cartman wanted to go to Casa Bonita. Funny episode, and I saw it back then. I was a big fan of South Park. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fake. Everything seemed so absurd. I thought it was just a whole fake thing.
Yeah.
And then it was only after I moved here did I realize, oh, it's actually a real place.
And it's a huge, like a castle of a restaurant, right? With like indoor diving or something? Or
Yeah, cliff diving inside.
So it's not just what you think of as a Mexican restaurant. It's an amusement destination where you can get Mexican food.
It's so cool. And then, so have you been there?
No, I don't think I have.
It's worth checking out. So a little more history. So the restaurant had a bit of a decline from, say, I'm not 100%. I was going to say from when it opened until it closed in 2020, mm-hmm. victim of COVID. However, Matt and Trey, they bought the shell of the spot. It's in a strip mall, by the way. So it's like there's a laundromat and like a Ross and whatever. It was like
kind of a sketchy neighborhood, if I recall.
Correct. Yeah. But you go in and you're like transported to whatever, a tropical forest. It's totally amazing. So they renovated it over the last couple years, and it's a very nice, entertaining, and because I had like a connection with a South Park episode, I was like going around and checking things out. We got our little picture taken in the fake jail downstairs, and there's actors going around and stuff. So it's definitely worth checking out. It's definitely kid oriented if you're not whimsical like me.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm gonna have to see it.
You should make reservations, and it'll look like it's totally full, but I'm not sure how they run it. So if you just sign up for the wait list, they'll often text you and you'll be able to just like sign up and probably be able to go whenever you want to go.
Yeah.
So food's much better. Total renovation. Got cliff divers. There's a magician show downstairs. Other actors. There's a puppet show. Little history. It's pretty fun.
Just the backstory is so cool. Like, I love the idea that these guys found success from making a TV show, and then they decided to take some of that money and put it back into just whimsical, ridiculous stuff right in their own town and bringing their childhood funny stuff back to life. That's totally what I would do. You know, the wealthier I got, the more I would do silly shit like that.
Do you have any ideas? I'm putting you on the spot, just in case you have something.
Nothing that's too silly. I'm still more in the hippie utopia thing, like a friend's mountain resort.
Fair enough.
Yeah, anything that needs to be. I mean, we did buy the place next to a pawn shop and turn it into the Mr. Money Mustache World Headquarters, which then later turned into the Phi Collective. So that was fun.
Yeah.
That was still somewhat whimsical. And it was off Craigslist, which I always enjoy.
That's awesome.
That being part of the story.
And I think next door, this is going to be like a nice space now that the pawn shop has sold out or whatever.
What an incredible turn of events. So for those who don't know this, I've been stuck next to a pawn shop because that's where I bought the building. And then that was recently repurchased for a much like a crazy amount of money, actually. And then they scraped it out like a pumpkin shell. Like there's nothing left inside and they're rebuilding it all high end. So even though I'm sure the finances won't work out for whoever bought it, I'm grateful that we're now going to be next to this beautiful like multi-restaurant building with all kinds of other stuff. And it's going to feed back positively on our little corner of downtown Longmont because it's all going to be classier now.
Fantastic.